from Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
There is obviously reference to the speaker and to people around the speaker. I want to know those connections. I want to understand what it is the speaker was doing. He needs to answer these questions. I think many, many of us have called for that. I mean, I think the speaker has an enormous amount to answer for. There are questions that the public needs to hear the answer to. I do too.
And that's Governor J.B. Pritzker. He was talking about the House Speaker Michael Madigan, the speaker facing pressure from federal prosecutors and from some lawmakers who say he should resign. Also ahead, some school sports will have to wait as health guidelines indicate it's too dangerous to compete amid COVID-19. We'll talk about that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. In our panel, practicing social distancing from his home, we have Charlie Wheeler. He's an emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. He's also a longtime State House reporter and observer. With us as well is Mary Hansen, reporter for NPR Illinois, and our guest is John O'Connor, who works for the Associated Press. John, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Let's recap that Commonwealth Edison has admitted to a bribery scheme where it gave jobs and contracts to help the Illinois House Speaker in exchange for assistance with favorable legislation. And now Madigan, who has denied wrongdoing, he's not been charged, but that has not stopped lawmakers from calling for his resignation. Even his counterpart in the Illinois House, the GOP leader Jim Durkin, now saying that. And as we sit down to record, at least seven Democratic legislators, including four in the House, have publicly made that call. One of those, Representative Kelly Cassidy of Chicago, her statement was pretty clear. She said whether these investigations ultimately implicate him or continue to pick away at his inner circle, the damage is done. John, the speaker even reportedly made calls to his caucus to gauge support. It appears he has enough support to stay in the position.
That's what the speaker says in a statement released late last night. The question I would have is, when you're the Speaker of the House and you are calling a member of your caucus, whom you probably almost fully financed to get into office, are you going to say to that person, no, I don't support you, Speaker? This is the crux of the issue. One of the big issues about Mike Madigan is that he is the Speaker of the House, and for 20 or more years he's been chairman of the state party. He has three campaign accounts that last time looked had just over $20 million combined. And so he can make or break a legislator's political life in Springfield and beyond. So he may have support when he talks to members. And that may be, as a practical matter, the truth, because what they tell him in confidence, those people might not be bold enough to contradict in a vote on the floor. So he may stay in there.
Now, a lot of these lawmakers who have come out and publicly called for Madigan to step aside are women. Should we make anything of that, John?
My suggestion to the women to whom I spoke yesterday was that maybe they had reached the boiling point sooner than the men, because they were the ones, and it's been women who have put the most pressure on Madigan in the last 3 years since the revival of the Me Too movement, in which we've seen a series of instances where his staff or House members were engaged or allegedly engaged in sexual harassment, his chief of staff running an environment of intimidation and bullying for 25 years in his office, email that surfaced last winter reported by WBEZ Radio, in which a confidant suggested that there had been a loyal employee who had kept silent about an alleged rape. And Madigan at each point has said, I didn't know anything about this. I didn't know anything about this. The women have never given him much quarter, and they've been pretty vocal. Yesterday, Iris Martinez, a state senator from Chicago, who is an influential member of both the state and national parties, and asked him to resign as party chairman because the national convention is coming up, said that when she joined the party, when she joined the Senate, she's the first Latina ever elected to the state Senate. And so she has a long history of standing up to Madigan, she said, because she had to in the early days. She was the only Latina, one of the very few women. There were only 8 women in the Senate when she joined. So, you know, she knew she had to be bolder than most. In this case, she said, she told me, quote, women have been bullied over there being the House. Women have been bullied over there for a long time. As women, we have to fight harder while the men take care of the men. But they all do predict that men eventually will join the chorus. That's what they predict. They're the ones who are out there, campaigning to get Madigan out.
Now, Charlie, this is just a whole nother layer on top of the scandal that's out there right now regarding Commonwealth Edison. Madigan, as we've mentioned before, has been able to weather a lot of these storms in the past. Your thoughts on what's happening right now?
Well, I think, as we've discussed in the past, this is maybe the most serious challenge that he's faced. And I think the reason that he called around to his members, there were a couple of reasons. One, as John indicated, he wanted to get kind of their sense of it. Are you with me or are you not with me? So that he could issue a statement saying that the majority of his members are still behind him. And, of course, he's done nothing wrong, as he said in his words, that he's innocent of all these charges, all the stuff that went on. He didn't know anything about it. So in a sense, he's sort of buying time to see how this shakes out. And part of it, too, I suspect that he is somewhat understanding if some of the members who are in tough reelection battles would appear to be against him. Because in the past, he's encouraged people to vote against his positions in the House when their vote didn't make any difference as whether a bill would pass or not, if it was good for them back home.
And Charlie,
I think one of the things that's enabled him to get to where he is he's been so diligent in protecting his members and in kind of doing whatever is needed to help them get elected in the first place and then get reelected.
And Charlie, he's been able to quell any type of dissension, quite often at least. And like you said, he's been able to also help out lawmakers and protect them when needed. So it's not necessarily surprising that some of these people would still be with him, especially without charges being filed at this point. Now that would be a whole nother, that would be a game changer on this issue. Of course, I would guess if charges came down.
Well, yeah, I would say that once charges came down, if he was officially indicted, that would be a whole new ballgame. Part of it is some of the discontent some of the criticisms are coming from suburban women who a decade ago would have had no chance of getting elected because of the political complexion of the suburbs. But the fact that the Republican Party has, I guess, move further to the right and is less moderate, particularly on the national level, has made the suburbs a much more potential place for Democrats to elect members. And as a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, I don't believe there are more than one or two Republicans in the House elected from districts in Cook County, which, of course, is totally different than what it was back when I was a reporter.
Well, Mary, the governor has been traveling the state. He's been urging people to wear masks and social distance. But the question that keeps popping up to him, of course, is Speaker Madigan and what the governor feels that the speaker should do. He's not gone as far as to urge Madigan to step down. He's been trying to carve out a position there, but he's been clearly, it seems, trying to separate himself as well. What's he been saying?
Yeah, so as we heard in the intro, there, that was him speaking a couple of days ago. Reporters asking him that question: What are his thoughts? And he's, sort of always included the caveat: if true, he says the speaker has a lot to answer for. There's more, there's a lot of questions out there. But Governor Pritzker has said, we want to hear answers to those questions, and has, as you say, hasn't gone as far as saying, he should step down.
Do you think, as far as Pritzker goes, though, I mean, he's got to be getting tired, of course, of getting that question, but at the same time, he's purposely not wanting to go that far. I mean, we've been talking about some of the reasons others don't want to do it. Pritzker's not doesn't have that loyalty with Madigan, I don't think. He doesn't need the protection of Madigan necessarily that some of these lawmakers might. So, you know, there might be people questioning, why hasn't the governor gone this far?
Well, the governor might not need Mike Madigan's money, but he certainly is a student of history, and he knows that, as Iris Martinez said yesterday when she came to her conclusion, you don't need to read between the lines of the ComEd agreement to know what's going on. Everyone knows that nothing gets done in Springfield without Mike Madigan signing off on it. As a governor, he has seen not only Bruce Rauner, a Republican, get absolutely nothing done because Madigan stood in his way, but previous Democratic governors with money, such as Rod Blagojevich. You know, it's kind of quaint the amount of money, that $27 million that Rod Blagojevich raised for his second campaign now when you think about Pritzker or Rauner. But in those days, remember, you know, he was a Democrat. He was a Chicago Democrat, and he would not or chose not to get along with Madigan. Madigan would not give him his way. So Pritzker, politically, legislatively, knows that if he wants his agenda passed, he needs Madigan. The difference is that, and this has been raised in several of the statements by the women who have come out against him. Heather Staines, for example, said that, you know, we all believe in innocent until proven guilty, but the speakership, the party chairmanship, are privileges. You know, you can be elected by the people to your House representative seat, but to be speaker, that's a privilege, and there should be no air of impropriety. So step down. And this is particularly pertinent to Madigan, and they pointed out that just last September, when former Representative Luis Arroyo was arrested on bribery charges, he still has not been gone to trial. He's pleaded not guilty. Madigan asked for his resignation. Last spring, or was it two springs ago, one of his top leaders, Lou Lang, from Skokie, was implicated in a sexual harassment charge. The charge was later determined to be unfounded. Now, that's because the complainant wouldn't cooperate in the investigation, but he was essentially cleared of that charge. But once he was charged, he was deposed from his deputy majority position. So this is a man, Mike Madigan's a man who believes that if there's an air of impropriety, you should not be involved in politics. So as Iris Martinez said to me yesterday, you want to live by the rules, you have to play by them, and that includes the speaker.
Charlie, you think that's fair as far as, I mean, again, he has not been charged with anything at this point?
Well, I think part of the considerations here, and this would certainly be something that would be on the governor's mind, is that the big issue on the ballot in November, in terms of the state's future, is this whole question about whether we should take out of the Constitution the current requirement that income taxes have to be leveled at flat rates and replace it with a graduated income tax, like the majority of the states and the federal government has, in which at higher levels of income, a greater percentage would be taxed. And the latest charges or implication of Madigan lends ammunition, I believe, to the people who are opposed to that. Because if you look at the amendment and you look at the accompanying legislation, it's very clear that most people would not pay more. And I think the percentage is something like only 3% of people would wind up paying more. But the people who are opposed to it are arguing, well, but you can't trust the legislature. As soon as this goes in, they'll tax retirement income. There'll be income taxes levied by cities and counties. Well, all that can happen now, but the notion of you can't trust them, they're crooks, this is going to play, and it's, what would you say, that argument is strengthened by this current brouhaha and the current ongoing investigation and the fact that the speaker is implicated in it.
John, before we move on, you wrote this week about term limits. We've heard about that through the years. A lot of people want to see that happen, both for lawmakers, for legislative leaders as well. Could this possibly lead to some change on that issue?
I don't think so. I think that even a lot of the reformers, we do have a constitutional amendment that's been filed by Springfield's Republican Representative Tim Butler to limit leaders to 12 years total, either in the minority or the majority. And as he points out, all the other caucuses, the Democrats and Republicans in the Senate and the Republicans in the House, have limited their leaders' terms by their chamber rules. When I turned in this story, an editor asked me, I don't think I understand this. Are you saying the House Democrats are the only ones who don't limit their leaders' terms? I said, yes, that's what I'm saying. And so on the one hand, you already have term limits. And, you know, with enough pressure, I think the other caucuses realized. And I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility that those caucuses decided on term limits because of the Mike Madigan question, that people were thinking that maybe he had been there too long. The thing that struck me about that story about looking at term limits was the chart I put together that showed the anomaly of Mike Madigan. How many Mike Madigans do you have coming along in history? He has served 18 terms as House Speaker, and the closest anyone's come to him is six. David Shanahan, a Republican in the 20s and 30s, who was elected and then lost the majority and then came back and was elected Speaker. So it's not, you know, it wasn't consecutive. So you have somebody who's 18 terms, and only five people in Illinois history have served more than two terms. You got to realize that that's a pretty rare occurrence. And so, you know, when people ask me, do we need term limits in the legislature? I say, well, look at it this way. I've been there 20 years and I've watched the chambers, the House and the Senate, turn over repeatedly. You always have new faces. You're always getting new ideas. And I would think, after looking at this, that aside from Mike Madigan, you have term limits in you know, over history, over time, over 200 years of Illinois history, you have term limits among leaders, too.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Mary Hansen, and John O'Connor with the Associated Press. Mary, this week the governor weighed in on school sports. That was anticipated, that we would be getting an answer on what would be allowed to take place and when. What was the final decision that was brought down this week?
Well, so there's two different things that happened on the same day. The governor put out guidelines that, you know, in partnership with the Department of Public Health and the State Board of Education, that put some more restrictions on youth sports. They apply to school leagues, recreational leagues, travel leagues, you know, park district programs, those sorts of things. And they, as they've done before, sort of put a framework on you know, what sports could be played when. They sort of put sports in lower, medium, higher risk categories. Tennis and golf would be sort of lower risk, basketball and volleyball in the kind of medium category. And then, you know, really high contact sports like football and wrestling are in the highest risk category. And then they lay out the levels of play, from no contact practices and conditioning all the way up to conference play and tournament play. And sort of said, at this moment in time, here's where all these different sports you know, sort of lie. And so football, for example, is the highest risk. And right now they said the only thing that's allowed is the level one play, which is no contact practices. Whereas, you know, tennis and golf, the lower risk ones, right now you could, you know, do some competitive play with a lot of safeguards in place. So the governor announced those restrictions. And then a couple of hours later, the Illinois High School Association, which oversees, you know, all the high school sports around the state, put out its plan for the season, and said it was going to shorten a lot of the season and then move some sports around. So football, for example, would not be played in the fall as it usually is, but they're going to plan to move it to the spring. It seems with the hopes that maybe, you know, we'll have the virus a little bit more under control and potentially actually be able to to play. So those are the two things. One interesting thing of note, the IHSA says in their press release that they're sending their plan to the Department of Health to approve it and to, it seems like, sort of make sure that their plan meets the guidelines that the governor put out earlier on Wednesday.
And I would guess, Mary, that part of the concern among some people is you can move these sports later, but there's still, no, like you had mentioned, there's no guarantee that things will be better come the winter, certainly, or the spring next year. So some of these sports could just be canceled altogether.
Yeah, and that's the point that the head of the IHSA also made on Wednesday was, this is a fluid plan and it could change. And so, if the governor said so as well, that part of the decision-making process is how much the virus has spread. And so, it is definitely feasible that if it's not under control by the spring, some of those seasons, some of those sports would be canceled.
John,
I wonder.
Go ahead, John.
How crowded the spring seasons will be? In high school, I went from wrestling into track and field, and track and field, I remember, began by early April. I think they've moved the spring sports to what they call summer sports: baseball, track and field, tennis, and they start in May and go into June. But it still seems like there's going to be all sports all the time during the spring. And I don't know. I assume that there's still a lot of kids in high school play multiple sports. So if you play basketball and you want to go to football, are they going to be able to participate in both? And not considering that the fact that the COVID is might still be out there, all things being normal, will it just be too much for kids and their families?
Well, and also I would guess, and Mary, I don't know that they brought anything like this up, but we're talking smaller schools. Like John had said, you do have multiple sport participation, and without kids doing that, you may not be able to field teams in some cases as well. So I would think that's going to be a problem also.
Yeah, it does seem that they, sort of have this, as you mentioned, John, sort of domino effect of moving some seasons, back a season, and then that affects the other ones that are then moved to the summer. But there could definitely be it. That was one of the things that the IHSA folks are saying. It's a sort of a complicated puzzle to try to put all of these pieces together. And I think that's also one reason they talked about, shortening the seasons as well.
Charlie, at the same time, we've got this issue here on extracurricular activities like sports. Next thing you've got is whether or not kids are going to actually be back in classrooms. In fact, the teachers unions in the state have come out and hinted at least at the possibility that there could be a work stoppage if their members are not comfortable in going back into the classroom. What's your thought on where things stand with schools at this point?
Well, I think it's all pretty much still unsettled. And if you look at the data, and this was reported, I forget where I saw it, but something like 11 out of the 15 largest school districts in the nation, it was a report by Education Week, which is a periodical that covers education, obviously. 11 of the 15 largest are going to be starting the school year remote only. And Chicago was unsettled at that time. And I think the difficulty is you don't really know what's going to happen. Are you going to be able to enforce the notion of if you open with classes on a couple days a week, are the kids all going to wear their masks? What happens if somebody doesn't? What happens if somebody winds up being a spreader and you have an outbreak in a school? Then does everybody go remote? It's still unclear. And I think the fact that the National Teachers Associations, both the National Education Associations, the American Federation of Teachers, have said that if any of their locals decide to strike because of unsafe conditions, what they consider unsafe conditions in the school environment, that the nationals will back them up with funding and with communications expertise, all of that kind of stuff. So I think the potential is still there that we may not do it. And as a matter of fact, a number of large suburban school districts in the Chicago area have already said we're going to begin and go to October or go through the fall semester doing it totally remotely without any participation within the school buildings.
And just about a minute here left, but Mary, some schools are also trying to give a choice to students of whether they come back fully or whether they stay online or maybe even something in between.
Yeah, so some school districts, including the Springfield School District 186, they're doing a survey of parents as they register their kids, asking them, do you want to do fully remote or do you want to, you know, start the school year going to school, you know, 2 days a week and then doing remote the rest of the days. And they've said that's both of those options are available and they will, you know, sort of plan their staffing levels and those sorts of things around that those registration numbers.
I think a lot of it's going to depend on what happens in the larger community than the school setting. We've, in the last couple of days, we've had numbers of infections that we haven't seen for months. And I think on Thursday, there were 1,772 positives, which is the largest number since back in May. And the governor has warned, as we heard, that if people don't start paying attention, start wearing masks, start doing the social distancing, be very diligent about it, we may have to roll back. And so we may wind up with schools being closed just because the virus has again erupted in the area.
It's time now for our notes from the field. And Mary, let's go to you first.
Yes. So I think a lot of us, if you haven't already, you probably will be getting in the mail a vote by mail application from your county clerk or other local election authorities. This is part of the law that was passed earlier this year, expanding the vote by mail program, requiring all these local election authorities to send out applications to anybody who voted in the last couple of elections. So you should be getting that soon.
Charlie?
Well, the latest from the attorney who has been challenging on behalf of his clients the governor's restrictions in a dozen or more different cases all around the state and numerous counties, Thomas DeVore announced earlier this week that he would halt all of his lawsuits if lawmakers returned to Springfield. He sent a letter to the General Assembly's four leaders saying that he's asking them to determine the rules for schools and businesses so both can safely resume operations without harming public health. And his point all along has been that the governor has exceeded his authority issuing these emergency declarations.
And John?
Michael Madigan has been Speaker of the House for 35 of the past 37 years. He was inaugurated on January 12, 1983. My colleague Mark Maxwell pointed out that when he became Speaker, the Bears were 8-8, and Walter Payton was ready to take them into the glory years. Fergie Jenkins was back pitching for the Cubs, and Ron Kittle had his Rookie of the Year, his one year in the sun, hitting 35 homers to the White Sox. I thought of that a different way, and I realized this morning that Madigan is the only person in the universe, I'm sure, who can claim that as Speaker of the House, he has watched championships won by the Bears, by the Cubs, go figure, by his beloved White Sox, and let's see, six by the Bulls, and I had to look this up but to make sure, but three Stanley Cups by the Blackhawks and three Major League Soccer championships by the Chicago Fire.
All right, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Mary Hansen, and John O'Connor with the Associated Press. Get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org. Production assistance was provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.